Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is TalkBack. Once a week, we take a program dedicated to answering questions and issues that are raised by people in the audience. No guest, no in-depth commentaries or investigative reports. That'll be for the other programs that we do. Give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I have a lot to share today about health and healing. And then I was watching Bill Maher, a person I don't like watching. I find him, well, I won't go into it, except to say I find the depth of the comments and conversation and lack of scholarship to be substantial. And last time I watched him, he had on some people supporting Obamacare, as he does. But they were doing it in very overstated ways. I'm going to explain through Stephen Ledman of The Real Agenda, an article he wrote called America's Fast Food Healthcare Coverage. And I'll share my own points on this as well. None of this being discussed with Obamacare, and it should be. Also, a lot of people in this country are treated for cancer. Well, according to new information shared by Green Med Info, Sayer G, millions are wrongly treated for cancer, but the natural approaches don't cause harm and are beneficial. And by the way, there's a National Cancer Institute panel confirms that they're being overtreated. How many people are dying because of that? For a long time in England, and also here, we were told that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR, was safe and effective. And yet, so many thousands of parents saw changes that were not good in their children after being vaccinated. And yet, any time there was a request for information, it was denied. Now, after 30 years, information that had not been known before has been made available on the MMR vaccine. And what it shows is that the government documents prove the vaccine was never safe. And it's taken 30 years. Think of all the suffering that's occurred because of that. So, as you can see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I was counseling a person this week who had type 1 diabetes and put him on a protocol. And he asked about flax. Well, there's new research just out, published in the peer-reviewed journal, Canadian Journal of Physiology and Pharmacology. And what it shows is that flaxseed can greatly benefit type 1 diabetes sufferers. And it's different. Type 1 and type 2 diabetes are different. And therefore, the diet is something that has to be modified if you're type 1. But this says that flaxseed has a wide range of benefits with type 1 diabetes. And among those benefits were an improved utilization of glucose, which is blood sugar, in the liver, and normalized glucose forming activity in the liver and muscle tissues, and reduced pancreatic and insulin and intestinal glucosidase inhibitory factor. So here is where you get the nutrients. First off, we know that there are natural compounds that actually can help regenerate healthy beta cells in the pancreas. Avocados, Swiss chard, raw honey, stevia, the natural sweetener, curcumin, and more. And type 1 is often referred to as juvenile diabetes because it is most often diagnosed in children. And they have it for a lifetime because the body's inability to produce insulin, whereas type 2 diabetes is where the body becomes resistant to its own insulin. It's not because, let's say, a child's diet may be bad. In other words, you can't solve it just by reducing carbohydrates or sugar intake. And almost all diabetics are insulin dependent. they require injections to make up for the fact that the beta cells of their pancreas are not producing the hormone so crucial to the metabolism of glucose. But now there's new research showing, hey, you can, like flaxseed and flaxseed oil. And that's good because it helps people. And also, and by the way, this gentleman went on the record by saying that before starting the protocol I put him on, after eating a meal, his blood sugar was 280. And then he found that it went down to 85 without insulin. So let's see if that continues. I'll have him on the air to show that. A lot of people ask about detoxification. And they hear about the one organ in the body that you really have to detoxify is the liver. And so then the question is, well, what do you use to cleanse the liver? What do you use as a detoxifier for the liver? Well, there are a lot of things. For example, I'm very big on chlorella and spirulina, two algaes that are very important because they're high levels of chlorophyll and phytonutrients. But also milk thistle is the top of the list of things that can detoxify not just the liver, but also the kidneys. And it contains betaine, which is a compound known to provide protection to the liver and essential fatty acids that are capable of controlling chronic inflammation. And also what is called semilmarin, which is very therapeutic and also can help with bile duct inflammation and liver fat filtration and hepatitis and cirrhosis. That's why milk thistle is so important. But also black cumin seed oil. Cumin, as in the herb that is common in Indian dishes. That's very important to take the oil 2 to 3 times a day, especially if cirrhosis of the liver or non-alcoholic fatty liver or hepatitis. And then we have dandelion. Dandelion is considered a pesky weed. In point of fact, the dandelion root and leaves are very supportive as diuretic of detoxifying the liver and the gallbladder. And I would use a little bit of dandelion, not a lot. And then licorice is a great detoxifier of the liver as well. The root works effectively in neutralizing a lot of chemicals. It stimulates a reaction to help the body detoxify. Now, the reason is because it has a particular acid. And this acid protects the liver from extreme damage. So those are the things that come to mind that are easy, inexpensive to use. Now, we have millions of people each year who are infected with E. coli. And there's a lot of people get sick, get in the hospital, even die from it. But a new study shows that from the Dutch, shows that using probiotics could make a difference. So when you consider millions of E. coli infections with no known treatment, and the fact that they can now use, I would say, 3 times a day probiotics, and that can help them. Quote, in vitro studies have shown that probiotics may be effective in controlling infections caused by E. coli 0157-87 in all 3 levels, end quote. And that was the head of this study. So that's good. Something that simple, because it's inexpensive and easy to get, the probiotics. Also, new evidence that vitamin D acts as a protective agent against advanced colon cancer. When you have advanced colon cancer in the United States, there's almost nothing they're going to do that's going to work. They'll try some experimental drugs, but I would never use an experimental drug. Let me tell you a story that I can verify firsthand, because I also saw as a trustee of Trafalgar Hospital and as a research fellow and scholar at the Institute of Applied Biology across the street for 30 years, that protocols get the priority, not the patient. It was 1977, And I was doing a Saturday show, which went from 4 hours, 10 to 2. And when I got out of the studio, I saw there was a gentleman waiting. And I said, "Can I help you?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Do you have a few moments? I'd like to share something." I said, "Sure." So I invited him back, and we sat down, and he said, "First, I'm not going to be able to tell you my name or where I work. You'll simply have to trust that what I'm telling you is accurate." And I said, "All right, what is it?" He said, "I've been involved in cancer treatment as a medical doctor and as a researcher for a long time, more than 20 years. And I'm so sick of what I'm saying that I listened to your show, and I felt maybe you would be open to doing an investigation into it because I read your articles on the politics of cancer, and they were the seminal articles out there. And I want to tell you, they put a lot of fear in the people because people where I work read them and passed them around. They were afraid that someone in our institution was giving you information." I said, "What's your story?" He said, "Time and again, a group of patients with cancer will get a protocol from for a new drug, an experimental drug. The doctors and attendants will see that the drug is not working and therefore should be taken off the drug, or at least the dose is reduced, but they won't." He said, "Where I work, whatever the protocol is, and that's created by the pharmaceutical company, not by the doctor or oncologist attending to the patient, that's the protocol that must be maintained. Even when the patient is clearly not responding well, even when the patient is dying because of the drug, the protocol is what is honored, not the patient." This is what he said to me. He said, "There are a lot of other people who've seen this repeatedly, and no one's going to say a word." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "You don't know where the money comes from. The money comes from the pharmaceutical companies or foundations where these pharmaceutical companies have given their money, hence it's a tax write-off, but they then have their own people to determine who they give it to. So you say anything at all that threatens the pharmaceutical industry, you'll never get another dollar of funding, and your career will come to an end." So he said, "But we all know it. We all see it. The media, the public is not aware of it. The government officials are not aware of it." So he told me that, and that was it. And I've had a lot of people drop information in my lap, and I'm not always able to follow it up to see if it's real or not. But as it would turn out, 5 years later, I happened to have seen that man at a medical conference. And then I found out who he was and the institution he was a part of. And he's a big deal, was a big deal. So when I hear that, oh, gee whiz, you know, they're giving colon cancer patients some experimental therapy. Well, fine. Show me the results before you give anyone a therapy. Show me how many patients with the same kind of cancer at this stage have reversed it, have had quality of life returned. If they can do that, then there's a reasonable chance that you could benefit. If they can't prove that, then they shouldn't be offering it, because millions upon millions upon millions of Americans have been injured, died, or suffered because they were given so-called promising treatments that were just there to make money for the pharmaceutical companies. So here's a study that was published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE and that was done at the Val Hebron Institute for Oncology. And they found that vitamin D made a difference in actually killing cancer. And in the field of colon cancer, numerous experimental and epidemiological studies show that vitamin D3 and some of its derivatives inhibit the growth of cancer cells. So that's important. So just let's hope that you never have cancer. But if you know someone who does, let them know about this research on vitamin D3. There's a protein, it's called beta-catenin, which is normally found in intestinal epithelial cells, where it facilitates their cohesion. And it builds up large quantities in other areas of the cell when the tumor transformation begins. And as a result of these changes, the protein is retained in the cell nucleus, where it facilitates the carcinogenic process. And this is the point at which vitamin D intervenes, or rather the vitamin D receptor. Quote, "Our study has confirmed the pivotal role of vitamin D in controlling the signal that sparks off the growth and uncontrolled proliferation of colon cells, which, in the final instance, ends up causing a tumor to emerge," end quote. And that was from a Dr. Hector Palmer, coordinator of the study. So, haven't read that in any of the papers. And again, a lot of self-censorship. Why would someone want D3 if you have colon rectal cancer, which is inexpensive, non-toxic, when the likelihood is you're going to spend over $100,000 for toxic drugs and therapy? Also, for those of you who, in the wintertime, are going to get your tanning, want to take one of those tanning beds, here's a new study, as reported in Science Daily and published in Addiction Biology. Quote, "Frequent tanning bed users exhibit brain changes and behavior similar to addicts. People who frequently are using tanning beds may be spurred on by an addictive neurological reward and reinforcement trigger," so says Utah Southwestern Medical Center, found in a pilot study. And that could explain why some people continue to use tanning beds despite the increased risk of developing melanoma, the most lethal form of skin cancer. The brain activity and corresponding blood flow tracked by the medical scientist involved in the study is similar to that seen in people addicted to drugs and alcohol. Quote, "Using tanning beds has rewarding effects in the brain, so people may feel compelled to persist in the behavior even though it's bad for them." That's according to Dr. Byron Adenoff, the professor who headed the study. Well, there's about 120,000 new cases of melanoma diagnosed each year in the United States. And young people, younger than 30, are 1,000% more likely to use those and on a frequent basis, and they have a much higher rate of developing malignant melanoma. Also, narcissists look like good leaders, but they aren't. This is an interesting study published in Psychological Science, a journal of the Association of Psychological Science, and reported in Science Daily. Here's what it says. Narcissists rise to the top. That's because of the people think their qualities, confidence, dominance, authority, and self-esteem make them good leaders. Is that true? Quote, "Our research shows that the opposite seems to be true," says Dr. Neveke, who oversaw the study at the University of Amsterdam. And the study found that the narcissist preoccupation with their own brilliance inhibits a crucial element of successful group decision-making and performance, the free and creative exchange of information and ideas. The findings will be published in the current issue of the journal. Now just think for a moment. Think of the people that we elect to our highest offices, or think of the people that run major corporations. These all exhibit qualities that seem appealing. They generally are attractive. They're very charismatic. They at least pretend to be empathetic with your suffering and your plight or your issues. They exude a confidence. They're always trying to take credit for something they've done. And they brag about their great decision-making properties, or they have others do it for them. But then look back at each of their records, and you tell me which one actually helped make it a better world and did so by making the government more, let's say, more realistic in its capacity to serve the American public. Now look at those people who were in office, for example, or corporations who only thought about themselves, made fortunes from the very people that they gave favors to in office when they leave office, and how much worse off the world is, and so many millions of people suffering because of them. Look at the unnecessary wars they start, like George Bush and Dick Cheney, and the people they surround themselves with, all charismatic, all very authoritative, all people who you believe can get the job done. Wolfowitz, these are people who are dynamic. Look at Wolfowitz of the World Bank. Look at him when he was Undersecretary of Defense. Look at Rumsfeld. All of them, in my opinion, sociopaths. They don't give a damn about anybody. They care about themselves. But they also have so much control over the media that they can create a legacy for themselves that has nothing to do with the truth or the reality. Same is true for Clinton, Obama, Reagan. These people were not good leaders, except for the people that elected them and selected them. Salt as addictive as cigarettes and heroin. This is interesting. This is a Professor Derek Denton at the University of Melbourne. Quote, "We all know that fish and chips wouldn't be the same without salt. However, scientists have now claimed that the yearning for salt stimulates the brain like addiction to hard drugs and cigarettes. They found that the craving triggers the same genes and brain cells in brain connections. The finding could help explain why many find it so hard to cut back on salt, despite warnings about dangers to blood pressure and heart health." And the activity in the brains is almost identical when you're taking salt as when you're taking heroin or smoking cigarettes. So how do you deal with this? By the way, this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Well, I do two things to help people wean themselves off salt. You keep the salty flavor first by shifting from regular salt to Himalayan pink salt. Then start using lemon juice. Then lemon juice with apple cider vinegar. And you can spray it onto a salad. You can spray lemon juice onto a baked potato, and it gives the salty flavor, but there's no sodium. And that's one way to do it. Too much television can give you diabetes. This is from the Times of India, and this is from Harvard School of Public Health. And researchers had indicated that prolonged TV viewing is associated with an increased risk of type 2 diabetes, plus cardiovascular disease, and premature death. Quote, "The message is simple. Cutting back on TV watching can significantly reduce type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and premature mortality." So says Dr. Hugh, professor of nutrition epidemiology at Harvard School of Public Health. Quote, "We should not only promote increasing physical activity levels, but also reduce sedentary behavior, especially prolonged watching of television." There's another part to this he didn't get to at all. When you're watching television, let's say on a Sunday afternoon, and you're watching a ball game, how many ads are for really unhealthy products? And I just want to see, so when in between the New England Patriots and the New Orleans Saints, two great teams, enjoyed watching, every single ad I saw was either for an alcoholic beverage like beer, which is really bad for your blood sugar levels and your pancreas, or something really fatty, really bad food. For those of us who eat healthy, it's bad. For the average person, A, they don't care. But now, how much time are you watching? Well, the average American watches television over 5 hours and 40 minutes a day. And what are they doing? They're eating during that time, because every time you see someone watching television on television, they're eating something or drinking something. Pizzas are a big deal. You know, all the toppings you want for $10. Or the other commercial where two whole meals for $10. And what are these meals? Well, there's a big steak and there's lobster. And what do people use on the lobster? Lots of butter. And how much fat's in the steak? Probably up to 50%. That could be 1,000, 1,200 calories just in the steak. Add in all the sodium and all the total calories, you're at 3,000 calories, way more protein than what the body can handle. And then the simple carbohydrates, the bread or muffins or the fries. Remember, the French fries always break down into really toxic carbohydrates because they've been deep fried. And deep frying creates massive amounts of acrylamides. And acrylamides are carcinogenic. And they're hard to digest. So that has to be considered. Not just the fact that they're not exercising, but the fact that they're eating an enormous amount of food that is terrible for our pancreas and for our blood sugar. And one final thing here, for those of you who'd like something good to help your arthritis, according to the peer-reviewed journal of Biological Chemistry, research done at the University School of Veterinary Medicine and Science in Munich, turmeric. You know, turmeric, the great Indian spice. They found that this spice can help turn off inflammation, and that can help with tendonitis and arthritis. So that's terrific. I would suggest, instead of turmeric, taking pure curcumin, because it's the curcumin, which is the active ingredient in the turmeric, that is good, and probably 1,000, 2,000 milligrams, do your best. One last one here. This is from the Food Research International, and it says the following. Red wine benefits the heart. Quote, wine polyphenols can protect the omega-3 fatty acids from breaking down in the body, offering a possible mechanism for cardiovascular benefits associated with red wine consumption. All right. So let's just go through that. That means when you have olive oil, or you have flaxseed oil, or you have cod liver oil or fish oil, you're getting the omega-3 fatty acids, and that helps you turn off inflammation in your heart, your brain, your muscles, your lungs. It's good for everything. But when you take the red wine in, or you could take grape juice, or you could take resveratrol, that allows the omega-3s to be protected and last longer in the body. Now, let me just think here. Red wine and olives. Red wine and olive oil on a salad. That's your classical Mediterranean way of eating. And they have a lot less heart disease than we do in the West. I'm Gary Knoll, starting the show with lots on health and nutrition. We're halfway in. Now it's time to go to your calls on our talkback segment. Our number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And just write this number down, because if there's ever a time when you're traveling and you're not near a internet connection, so you could hear Progressive Radio Network over the air, over your computer, or maybe you're not near a land-based station, so the only thing you have is a cell phone. Oh, you can put it on speaker. Here's the number you would call, and you can always get through. 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. And of the some 5,000 services using it, we were number one. In fact, they came by our studio and gave us an award for that. And so we got how many last month alone? I think we passed 500,000 just last month. A lot of people listening over the telephone. Back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us. all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's say hello to Anna from Brooklyn. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Gary. Hello?
How can we help you?
Oh, yes. Okay. I was interested in your opinion on organ transplantation.
Well, you have to have a context for that. What would be the context?
Well, I need to have lung transplants because of fibrosis. And I know it's a lot of things that go against what I believe. Like they want a copy of vaccines, and they want you to have these vaccines in place before they would do anything like that, before they would go ahead with the transplant. You know, that's one of the requirements.
Well, I can never tell anyone whether to or not get a vaccine. What I can ask is this. Ask them to provide you with scientific evidence from peer-reviewed literature, independent literature, not the pharmaceutical company that made the vaccine, that vaccine has been proven safe and effective for you in the conditions that you'd be vaccinated for. Mm. That's number one. Number two, there are people who have fibrosis and have sought alternative therapies, and you should also look to see how you could enroll in one of their protocols and what benefit that could accrue. There's also some new stem cell research that you should be looking at. Dr. Krugler in California has done some exciting work, but there's lots of people doing exciting work on stem cells for different organs. Mm-hmm. And lastly, you should examine some of the work in Germany of where they're doing transplant work and to stimulate a rejuvenation of the actual specific organs. I visited some of these clinics before doing an article on it and found it was a paradox. I'll give you one example. Klaus Martin clinic I went to. Mm-hmm. There were about 50 guests there from all over the world, and they were there to get some what is called a transplant. Mm-hmm. And the transplant came from the fetuses of sheep that were specially raised in the high country with no pollutants. And these are not injections. These are real transplants. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a long, large gauge needle that goes in the buttock, and it has specific. And I was told in the United States that there was no science behind this at all, that it was all quackery based upon a Dr. Niehans from the 1920s and 30s. And yes, JFK and Winston Churchill and some other famous people had received this therapy, but it had nothing to do with science. Well, I went to the University of Heidelberg, and they had over 500 different studies on the efficacy and safety of these. In fact, I spent 2 days just studying all the literature. Then I went to a veterinary university in Vienna, and they had hundreds of studies as well. And then, most importantly, I asked the people, do you notice any difference? And without exception, they all said yes. Some of the people have been coming back for over 30, 40 years. Now, these were not health-minded people, and that's what surprised me. That was the irony. You would think that if someone wanted to help their lungs or liver or heart or kidney or brain, that they would be on a holistic protocol. They wouldn't be smoking and drinking. To the contrary, these people smoked, drank, and were intending to change nothing. And they'd come every 3 to 5 years and get these injections, and that would rejuvenate them. So the science is not in question. Does it mean something? In fact, I saw one particular study where they put they marked the fetus cells that were specific and then looked in the body once these were implanted, and the vast majority of these cells went to the specific organ. If it was pancreas, they went to the pancreas if a person was diabetic. So that's just something of interest that we never discuss about in this country. And then the T cells we don't discuss with any interest because it's not being done. It's still being researched. Right. But if you go to any of these international conferences on anti-aging that I do and I speak at, you'll see that there's thousands of people doing the research here. So all that I would also consider. But if you need a transplant, by all means, then seek a transplant. There's absolutely nothing wrong with getting a transplant. if you need a heart transplant or a liver transplant or a kidney transplant or whatever the transplant may be, it's just don't have them do any procedure that in and of itself could lead to iatrogenesis or medical complications. And just ask them for the very proof that would give you some comfort.
It's such a, because they have you go to these meetings to learn and know what's going on, what's going to happen. And one of the things they tell you is that you cannot eat organic foods anymore, which disturbed me quite a bit. And there was something else.
Well, what they have to do for a period of time, they have to, in effect, keep the immune system from overreacting. And therefore, that's understandable. But we've also seen, if they say you can't have organic foods, then say, all right, then tell me what would be the advantage of eating a genetically engineered potato versus an organic potato. What would be the disadvantage in eating the organic? Don't just take their word for it. There's this assumption in the United States that when people are giving a medical protocol or a public health protocol, that somehow they have an insight and a wisdom that others don't. I and everyone else would like to trust your physician. And when it comes to emergency medicine, it's a trust well deserved, because we do better at emergency medicine and saving someone's life, or if they've had a heart attack or stroke, or they've a seizure, or they have trauma, they've punctured an eye, they've knocked out teeth. We're great at helping people in crisis. But chronic care, which represents 85 to 90% of all medical care, we fail miserably. Not only do we fail, but it's the number one cause of preventable death and number one cause of preventable injury. We've proven that using their own statistics in a major article I did called Death by Medicine with four scholar co-authors that we spent 5 years doing our research. And time again, you'll have people who are absolutely certain that a procedure is necessary, that it's safe and effective, but then you ask them, where is your independent research to prove this? And it doesn't exist. And the worst case is vaccines. Because not only can they not show you that any given person would be helped and not hurt by a vaccine, but they're then protected for their lives. Now, if you have a problem with, let's say, a statin, and you can sue, and then it all comes out, oh, gee whiz, they never really had the proof. Well, if they didn't have the proof, then they shouldn't have been doing it, but they make money. And they make enough money that the cost of settling a lawsuit is the cost of doing business. And that's what happened, for example, with Vioxx. Now, unless I'm mistaken, not one of the tens of thousands of rheumatologists that caused the death of a minimum of 60,000 Americans, but some state that the number is closer to 500,000, and over 150,000 heart attacks and strokes, and no one did a follow-up to see how many of them had a second heart attack or stroke and died. But that meant that in 4 years, American medicine, through one drug, Vioxx, that was known to be dangerous and known it would increase risk of heart attack and stroke, based upon a whistleblower, Dr. Graham, they killed more Americans than all of Americans who died in the Vietnam War, which is 10 years. No one was found guilty. No one went to jail. No one's reputation was sullied. In fact, the stock in the company went up the day they settled, because now that was supposedly behind them. The trouble was that same company also had about 60 other major lawsuits. And what we don't realize is that all these pharmaceutical companies have spent untold amount of money in killing people, injuring people, price fixing, bribery. It's just the way they do business. And yet they're held up as a model, a standard. And American medicine's held up a model as a standard, and it shouldn't be. It's a disgrace, and it should be challenged for its mistakes and lauded for its successes. Well, look at the war on cancer. Where's its success? It's had 44 years. Where's its success? Let me read this to you from Christina Sarich. UCLA study shows radiation treatment makes breast cancer worse. Quote, published in the well-respected Cancer Journal, a recent study conducted at UCLA Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center describes how radiation treatments actually promote malignancy in cancer cells instead of eradication. More than 200,000 women a year develop breast cancer in the United States. At least 2,000 men do as well. And while Susan G. Komen and other breast cancer-related nonprofit organizations struggle to keep afloat, we can wonder why. Simply studies like this one, a malignant disease, is one which is virulent, invasive, and uncontrollable. It can even become deadly. It is the opposite of curable. In contrast, there are a number of natural treatments coming into light in reference to breast cancer, specifically which don't require expensive radiation treatments and certainly do not cause cancer cells to go rogue and grow uncontrollably. Raw vegan diets and herbal remedies such as turmeric and black cohosh are examples of simple solutions. None of these remedies cause your hair to fall out, skin problems, inflammation of the mouth, tongue, anemia, the development of hyperlymphedema, and extreme nausea. The study found that radiation actually induced breast cancer cells to form more tumors and malignancies in radiation-treated breast cancer or breast cells was likely to be 3,000% more probable. And while radiation treatments can temporarily regress tumors, this is only the false appearance of eradicating the disease, as the study points out. The treatment may seem to work for a short time, but the ratio of highly malignant cells to benign cells begins to spiral out of control soon after. This can lead to a treatment-induced death, not from the original appearance of the cancer, but from the radiation treatment itself. Researchers from the Department of Radiation Oncology at UCLA Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center report that radiation treatment transforms cancer cells into treatment-resistant breast cancer stem cells, even as it kills half of all tumor cells, end quote. Even more alarming is the fact that radiation treatments can cause some cancer stem cells. They can behave like regular cells but develop into tumor-forming cells. Scientists are not sure how this happens to date. Some doctors are looking to reduce the amount of radiation therapy given to patients in light of this evidence. But many more should consider natural therapies that do not create a false healing, which cause cancers to grow back with even greater force. Yet another study published in the journal Stem Cells found that ionizing radiation reprogrammed less malignant breast cancer cells into iBSCs. Cancer stem cells are especially non-responsive to chemo and radiation treatment. This is why these medicines often don't work. And it goes on then to talk about what does. For example, astragalus, the Chinese and Ayurvedic herb, is anti-cancerous. And when used at MD Anderson Cancer Center with radiation treatments, it greatly lowered the number of metastasized cells. Bloodroot has been known to kill cancer cells, and one of its constituents causes cancer cells to die. Cat's claw has been shown to help reduce cancer tumors. Butcher's broom has been shown in treating breast cancer, especially reducing swelling after surgery. Turmeric, a root, can help slow metastasizing cells from breast cancer. And hemp oil is proving to be a great cancer preventative and tumor reducer. So keep in mind, this is mainstream science, and yet you haven't heard a thing about it anywhere. Now then there's a separate article from Sayer G. Green Med Info. Quote, a devastating new report commissioned by the National Cancer Institute reveals that our 40-year war on cancer has been waged against a vastly misunderstood enemy that in many cases represented no threat to human health whatsoever. And then it goes on to talk about the dark side of Breast Cancer Awareness Month and how a lot of breast cancer is not breast cancer at all. These are benign lesions, what are called ductal carcinoma in pseudo, and that by repeatedly using x-rays, breast screening are not only highly carcinogenic, but also causing an epidemic of overdiagnosis and overtreatment in U.S. women, with an estimated 1.3 million cases in the past 30 years. So this week, the National Cancer Institute commissioned panel reports in the Journal of the American Medical Association that public and professionals alike should stop calling low-risk lesions like the ductal carcinoma and high-grade prostatic neoplasia cancer. It's not cancer. And there are wide-reaching implications for this recommendation, including millions of women in this country have been diagnosed with the ductile carcinoma, but it's not a cancer. And millions of men and subsequently are mistreated. And they're now being retroactively reclassified as victims of iatrogenesis, meaning they have legal recourse to seek compensation. And anyone engaged in a cancer screening will now need to reconsider and weigh both the risks and benefits of such a so-called preventative strategy. So I'm saying err on the side of caution. Do your homework, because these studies are showing that what was an absolutely proven therapeutic model for dozens of years was false. It caused overdiagnosis, overtreatment, and by calling lesions cancer, they weren't. Some women had breast lesions and had their whole breasts removed, just mutilating and massacring women. I can assure you this, Anna, that had the same number of men been castrated as women were mutilated, this would never have happened. But we value men's testicles more than we do women. And that's just the way it's always been. That's unfortunate. It should not be apologized. It should be eradicated. So women, unfortunately, have believed in the myth of the authority figure. And we are here as one of the few voices to say, do your homework so you're not a victim. Okay? All the best to you. Now, this is something I mentioned at the beginning of the program. How rare it is to find out through some government agency releasing documents that they've been lying for years. In this case, for 30 years, the government held in secret studies that they could prove that the MMR vaccine was unsafe. Quote, from Christina England, Back Truth. Many parents are opting to have their children vaccinated with the single measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines due to growing concerns about the safety of the MMR, but are they jumping out of the frying pan into the fire? Hidden government documents have revealed that leading professionals have had serious concerns about the safety of the single measles vaccine for many years. Secret government documents that have been under lock and key for 30 years have revealed that the government has known for many years that the single measles vaccine can cause the debilitating neurological disorder called SSPE. That means subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. And by the way, that is a really serious degenerative neurological condition, and it affects a person's behavior and memory and coordination, and it can cause fits and blindness and eventually death. And the Disabled World News says that the symptoms a person with SSPE experience are subtle. Quote, they usually include symptoms such as changes in behavior and mild mental deterioration, such as memory loss. The symptoms that follow are commonly involuntary jerking movements of the person's head, limb, or trunk jerks, and additional motor function disturbances. The person may experience seizure activity or become blind. As the disorder advances, the affected person might lose the ability to walk as their muscle spasms or stiffen. The person progresses towards a comatose state followed by a vegetative state. People with SSPE commonly die as a result of fever, heart failure, or the brain's inability to continue controlling their autonomic nervous system, end quote. Now, in 1972, serious concerns about the measles vaccine potential to cause vaccine-induced SSPE had grown in momentum. It was decided that a group called the Expert Group on Surveillance of SSPE was needed to study the problem in more detail. And on February 9th, the medical director wrote a request to leading professionals asking them to attend a meeting. On March 13th, 1972, in room D101 of the Alexander Fleming House. His letter contained a section of documents which stated, quote, may form a base of discussion. Well, the members of this group were listed as a separate committee, And they found, and I got the list of all the people here, of all the different hospitals and the major things, and quote, there's been, this is from the actual meeting, there has been concern recently about the suggestion that measles vaccine might occasionally give rise to a subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. Professor Sir Charles Harris, the chairman of the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, has asked whether members of the association could be prepared to notify cases we see. Note the words might occasionally, which were specifically chosen to cover the fact that it was a growing problem. Now, this document, along with many others uncovered, means that the measles vaccination was proving problematic to the neurological well-being of young children as far back as 1972. If this were the end of the matter, then it would be easy to assume that the problem had been overcome. However, the problem of vaccine-induced SSPE continued to persist even when the measles vaccination was combined with the mumps and rubella vaccination to form the MMR triple vaccine. What this meant was cases of vaccine-induced SSPE were not only occurring after children received the single vaccine, but they were also occurring after they received the MMR vaccine. And a staggering 15 years later, during the adverse reaction vaccination immunization meeting on the 6th of July, 1987, in item 5, MMR vaccine, 5.4 postpartum rubella immunization associated with development, quote, of prolonged arthritis, neurological sequelae, and chronic rubella arthritis tingle. This was published in the Journal of Infectious Disease, volume 152. And then Dr. Kavanaugh reminded the committee of a SSPE-like syndrome reported from rubella virus infection, noting that the reported maternal transmission of rubella virus in breast milk, which was discussed in the subcommittee. So they had all this information, all this incriminating information, for all these years. And each one of the reports gets even more damaging. Not a word of this was ever given to the public. So what do we know now? The papers that were obtained from the archives talk about various conditions brought on by the measles vaccine by itself. Convulsions, encephalopathy, the deafness, paralysis, leukemia, status epileptus, died 48 hours later, fits. So that's what they knew. So, but it was always labeled not for publication. So the public was denied the opportunity to know the truth, yet the doctors overseeing the entire vaccine program knew. So Anderson Cooper, you and Dr. Gupta and everyone else that criticized Andrew Wakefield for his examination of the relationship between the measles vaccine and MMR and intestinal disturbances in children who had been diagnosed separately and not by them of autism, he was right. Your McCarthy type of journalism, your red-baiting journalism, is reprehensible. He was right. You were all wrong. And now we know the truth. And that's what we try to share on this program. Real quick, before we end, Luann Panessi has a letter from one of our listeners. Hi, Luann. Yes.
Hey, Gary. I have something here from Roger from New Jersey. I thought it might be interesting to share. He says, I just realized something. My dog sleeps about 20 hours a day. He has food prepared for him. His meals are provided at no cost to him. He visits the doctor once a year for his checkup and again during the year if any medical needs arise. For this, he pays nothing, and nothing is required of him. He lives in a nice neighborhood in a house that's much larger than he needs, but he's not required to do any upkeep. If he makes a mess, someone else cleans it up. He has his choice of luxurious places to sleep. He receives these accommodations absolutely free. He's living like a king, and he has absolutely no expenses whatsoever. All of his costs are picked up by others who earn a living, and I was just thinking about this, and suddenly it hit me like a ton of bricks. My dog is a congressman.
Yeah, and boy, they're worthless, aren't they? I'm incredulous that they don't have a 1%. I think they're 9% favorable review now. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.